My name is Vlad. I'm at Bell Labs, which is, can you hear me? Yeah. Which is part of Lucent, but I think Debbie yesterday said that Lucent is now been bought or merged with Alcatel. So I'm proud to have been selected to be the first speaker of the new company. And there was actually internal competition which I won, and Debbie and Juan didn't win. And this is, last night I went, I looked up the, I don't know when the online, the new website, I guess, went online yesterday. So it's all going to be blue, and previously was red, but my slides are going to be red. So I'm going to talk about comparing encrypted numbers 2 million years and related questions, related applications. This is joint work with Ian Blake here at the University of Toronto. So I look at previous presentations. Everybody gave a table of contents. I also gave a table of contents. I'm going to talk about background and then the problems that are being solved. The 2 million years problem and then sort of extension or generalization, which is comparing encrypted numbers. So the 2 million years problem, everybody have heard about it. It's the setting is there are two parties. Both of them have their private input, and they want to find out whose input is greater. They both know the plain text of their inputs. And it turns out, well, it's pretty obvious, but I'll talk about applications where it makes it even more obvious that it's useful to be able to compare encrypted numbers where you don't know the plain text. So the motivation is pretty clear. Anywhere you want to do some kind of financial transaction, you want to buy something, bargain, or things like that, then there is some use for evaluation of the greater than predicate and for secure evaluation of the greater than predicate. So, for example, Alice wants to buy something. So, she's seen those very, very nice sunglasses. She calls Bob and says how much. Bob is the seller of those sunglasses. But Bob doesn't want to, depending on his business model, it's not always possible for Bob to just put a fixed price. Right, for example, this matrix sunglasses, he gets them for $5 somewhere. He wants to sell them for $200, but somewhere in between, he might be able to make a deal. So he cannot tell, you know, that, okay, $20, right, because he's probably going to get more for them. So instead, he asks Alice, just tell me how much money you've got, and then I'll be able to, you know, if the deal is possible, then we're going to make a deal. And I'll even make you a really good deal. I'll sell it to you for my possible lowest price. But if it's not possible, then I'm not going to tell you how much. Okay, Bob doesn't really trust Alice, but Alice also doesn't have to really trust Bob because Bob can be lying. And as soon as Alice tells him that she's got $100 to spend, then he's going to sell sunglasses to her for $99.99. So you can evaluate the greater than predicate there. And there is other uses than saving money on buying sunglasses. There's other uses of this functionality. I want to mention, I guess, well, several auction systems as sort of the most natural and practical and useful. I'm going to talk in more detail about it in the second part of the talk, so I'm going to skip it for now. Secure database mining, is a seemingly unrelated thing, but it's not. So here the setting is there are two parties, each have a database which they want to keep private, and they want to do a database mining on their joint database. So a natural scenario would be two credit card companies have databases of users. They want to mine for fraud detection, for example, and it's pretty natural that mining a joint database will give you better results than mining their database separately. But for natural reasons, also the credit card companies want to keep their databases private. It turns out that very popular algorithms to mine databases rely on a large number of evaluation of the greater than predicate. And once you separate those databases, then these evaluations will need to be evaluated securely. Sales of electronic goods, I guess this is a sort of version maybe of selling things. And if I have time left, maybe I'll mention a few words. It was a very nice paper of Aiello, Ishai, and Rheingold in Eurocrypt 2001, which they show how to sell movies or software subscriptions or anything like that. And also they rely on evaluation of the greater than predicate. Okay, so right, so the background is kind of longish, but maybe I'll try to speed up a little bit. Secure function evaluation. This is what you do when you don't trust your partner. You want to do some business with your partner, but you don't fully trust them. And pretty much the most general way you can look at it is evaluation of a function f on a general function f on private inputs of parties. So parties have their input, want to keep them private. We assume secure channels, so we don't worry about external attackers. We only want to protect against malicious or not too honest behaviors of our partners. Okay, so pictorially, Alice and Bob, there's a function. Alice and Bob have inputs, and they. So my goal as a protocol designer is to create this protocol, upon completion of which both parties output the value of f. So I'm going to talk about one round secure function evaluation, which I think is interesting. So in one round, I'm going to remove whatever these three dots. I'm not allowed these three dots between these two messages. So there's only one message. Alice sends one message to Bob. Bob sends a message to Alice. It's pretty obvious that now Bob is not going to be able to output anything in his computation, right? Because no secure protocol would allow Bob to do that. It's easy to see because if there were such a secure protocol so Alice sends a message to Bob. Bob, you know, plugs his input and outputs something, right? So nothing stops Bob from plugging in several different inputs and outputting several different values. So such, and that would leak too much information. So that's not good. Okay, right. Obvious things: malicious and semi-honest. Everybody have heard about them. So malicious adversaries, they're the players who can do whatever they want to do. In polynomial time. They know the instructions, they know the protocol that they should evaluate, but they don't have to follow it. A very meaningful restriction of that is a semi-honest model. Why do people consider it? Because it's sort of, first of all, simpler to think in that model, and that's actually the protocols I'm going to talk about are in the semi-honest model. But I'll say a few words about extensions in the malicious model. So it's easier to think about the semi-honest model, and also it's easier to construct more efficient protocols in a semi-honest model. And then once you have a good efficient protocol in a semi-honest model, then you can either apply a very general transformation using zero-knowledge proofs and convert your protocol in one secure in a malicious model, or you can do something else. And I want to say a few words of what that something else is. So there are several reasons why one-round protocols are interesting, and one that I don't see very often emphasized, and I wanted to say a few words, is that this relationship between malicious and semi-honest model, relationship between security in the semi-honest and malicious model is easier to sort of look at and analyze and get for cheaper in these one-round solutions. So if you look at one round, what happens? Alice sends a message to Bob. Bob replies, and Alice computes the answer. There's only sort of two things that Alice can. There's two places where Alice can deviate from prescribed protocol. Right? She can substitute her input, and then whatever she gets from Bob, she can maybe misinterpret and lie about it. Right? So she doesn't do any other computation. So there's no need for proving these complicated things. And both of these points of opportunity of Alice to cheat can be relatively easily protected using no tools.
Alice doesn't have to react as if the other input said something that did not messages that do not that don't have any that she doesn't know any input, the input or doesn't have a corresponding input.
Okay, say again, Alice what? Alice?
Doesn't correspond to any input.
Yes, that's right. So you can do some kind of zero knowledge proof that she knows her input, or right, that's what you mean. So there is this thing. Okay, but so in some settings you do need, you know, this very strong notion that you want to prove that you know your input. But often what is sufficient is that if you substitute your input or if you lie about it, you will not be caught maybe by Bob, but you're not going to get any benefit from the computation. So for example, if you're buying a movie online, right, which is essentially buying a decryption key, right, if you substitute your input, if you lie about it, you're going to get back garbage and you didn't gain anything, right? So in many settings this is sufficient. Okay, is that answer? Okay. And in many settings, it is sufficient to consider this asymmetric trust between parties. For example, Alice could be a client and Bob can be a bank, and it's reasonable to assume that bank has a lot of stake in his business, and he's not going to deviate from the protocol. He's going to behave semi-honestly. Maybe he'll try to spy on you a little bit, but not too much. He's going to do what he's supposed to do. But on the other hand, Alice could be a hacker, and we don't want to trust everybody, you know, all the clients of the bank to behave semi-honestly. So in this case, it is convenient. So what we can do in this case is design a semi-honest protocol, a really cheap and efficient semi-honest protocol, and then add selective protection. And in case of one-round semi-honest protocols, we get cheap selective protection against malicious behaviors of Alice. So that's nice. Right, so that's the point I wanted to make. And the other things are kind of obvious. One-roundness reduces latencies. And some applications, you know, do require interactivity. And, okay, I've listed some, but we don't have to go through them. You can believe me. Okay, let's see. So what happens during one round secure function evaluation? Alice has to send some kind of encryption of her input to Bob. Bob is going, he doesn't know what X is, so he's going to manipulate this encryption and send back to Alice some kind of encryption of some kind of encoding of the value of the function. And there is homomorphic encryption that lets you do stuff underneath without knowing what is going on. Okay, and now in the end, okay, so you said that Alice can compute the answer, but Bob cannot in one-round protocols. But if Bob does want to know the answer, then he can ask Alice to send him something back. In the semi-honest model, it's fine. He just says, send me something back, and Alice does that because she cannot lie. But we're talking about this, you know, semi-honest protocols, which we later want to sort of make them efficiently, efficiently want to make them sort of secure in a malicious model. So we don't want to rely that Alice honestly sends the output, but this is easy to enforce. Instead of sending in this message to Alice, instead of sending simply the value of the predicate, you can send some kind of authenticated value of the predicate, for example, Bob's signature. Okay. And the security notion that is associated with this idea is what we call strong conditional oblivious transfer, which is it's an oblivious transfer. It's a variant of oblivious transfer. Here there is Alice and Bob. Alice has input X, Bob has input Y, and Bob also has two secrets. There is a public predicate Q, which everybody knows. And upon completion of the protocol, Bob's going to learn absolutely nothing. And Alice is going to learn the value of the secret, one of the Bob's two secrets, that corresponds to the value of the predicate that is evaluated on parties' inputs. And you can see that this is a generalization of oblivious transfer, right? Because if you want to get oblivious transfer from this, you can set the predicate Q to be equal to X. Q of XY is equal to X. This will immediately give you oblivious transfer. And this is a generalization of the secure function evaluation, also because you just set S0 to be equal to 0, S1 is equal to 1, and this will give you a evaluation of the predicate Q. Okay, additively homomorphic encryption. I don't have to go over the slide too much. You can basically give an encryption of two messages. You can compute the sum of messages. under encryption, and you can compute linear functions. So if you know the constant C and you know encryption of a message, you can compute encryption of constant times message. This is done by repeated addition. Okay. All right, so now if, you know, there was background, now you can wake up and see the actual protocol, which should be understandable. Okay, so Alice has input X, which I'm going to write out as bits, X1 through XN, X1 being the most significant bit, and Bob has input S0, S1, which are Bob's secrets, which are strings, and bits Y1 through YN. Alice is going to initialize her encryption scheme, the Pallier encryption scheme, which is additively homomorphic and has a large plaintext domain. It's going to take her input bits, encrypt them, so the orange squares are going to denote encryptions. Right. And she's going to send her encrypted bits together with the public key together, to both of them, to Bob. So what can Bob do with this, with the things that he knows by this time? Well, he knows his input and he knows the encryptions of Alice's bits. So clearly he can compute the vector of bit difference, right? Because you can compute, you can subtract, you can add and subtract under the Pallier encryption scheme. He can also compute the vector of XORs of the bitwise XOR vector between vectors X and Y, right? This one is a little bit less obvious, but also not too hard to see, because X XOR Y, you can check that it's equal to X minus Y squared, right? Because if X is equal to Y, then this is going to be a zero, and this is okay. If X is not equal to Y, then it's going to be 1 or minus 1, but you square it, it's going to be a 1. So it's exactly the same. And then you write it out as X squared minus 2XY plus Y squared, but we're dealing with bits, so X is equal to X squared, so you just X or Y is equal to this, right? There is a multiplication here, but it's not a problem because it's not a problem for Bob because Bob knows why, right? So he can compute this expression under the encryption. Okay, everybody believes? Okay. So I'm going to work with these two vectors. I'm going to call them vector D and vector F. D is for difference, F is for flag vector. So I'm going to show it by example what I'm doing, and that, I think that will be easier. So vector F is a vector of zeros and ones, right? And the zeros are in the positions where X and Y are different, where X and Y are the same, and ones are in positions where X and Y are different. So if you look from the left to right on vector F, the first position from the left where X and Y are different is the position that we care about. And I want to somehow isolate this position. And because D in the same position gives me the answer to the greater than predicate, right? So what I want to do, what I'm going to do is randomize all the positions of this vector with the exception of this position. So how to do it? I'm going to compute vector gamma as follows recursively. I'm going to set gamma 0 to be 0 and gamma I to be 2 times gamma I minus 1 plus Fi. And it's easier to see by example. So vector gamma is going to start with several zeros. So as long as F is equal to 0, gamma is going to be equal to 0 by construction, right? Because this 0 is equals 2 times previous 0 plus this 0. This 0 is the same. This one is equals 2 times previous 0 plus this, etc. So what I get is that there's going to be some zeros, then there's going to be a 1 in a position that I care about, and then there's going to be some non-ones, right? Because I'm multiplying this by 2. And with high probability, these are going to be non-ones. I mean, it can wrap around, and it so happened that, because this is all in modular arithmetic, right? So it can wrap around and get to 1, but the probability of that is negligible. So I don't care about that. Okay, so the important property of this vector is that there's a single 1, and that 1 is in the position that I care about. So this already sort of makes it pretty clear what I want to do. And how to do it. I'm going to compute this vector delta, which is equal to delta I is equals to di plus ri, where r is a random element of the polylinear plaintext, times gamma I minus 1. And what this will do, well, first subtract a 1, so what I'm going to get is a vector of some things that I don't care about, but with a 0 in a position that I care about. Then I'm going to multiply everything by random, different random for different coordinates. Then it's going to be all random stuff except 0 here. When I add the vector d coordinate-wise, so everything is done here under encryption, so Bob doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't know the values, but just knows that this box contains something. He can do stuff with those under inside the boxes. So when I add the vector d, then what I'm going to get, well, addition doesn't destroy random. Addition of a constant doesn't destroy randomness, so I'm going to get another vector of random numbers and the answer to the greater than predicate in a position that I care about. So now, if Bob simply sends this vector back to Alice, then it's pretty much okay. It pretty much is the answer to the greater than predicate. Well, it gives the answer to whose number is greater, and it hides pretty much everything except with a tiny bit of information, right? Because this vector, how does this vector look? It's just a vector of random numbers. The only thing that is leaking some information is the position of this. Is the position where this 1 or minus 1 is located, and Alice will be able to tell what is the magnitude of the difference between x and y, right? But this information is also very easily hidden by simply permuting, randomly permuting the the vector and sending back to Alice. But I want to send something else. I don't want to simply send the value of the predicate. I want to send some secrets that, you know, Bob wants to send some secrets that he knows as one of the two secrets is 0 and as 1. But this is easily done by applying a linear function to each of the coordinates, and that linear function needs to map a minus 1 to s 0 and a 1 to s 1. That's easily constructed. You can easily apply that. Linear function does not destroy randomness of these things, so everything is going to be fine. Okay, so after computing the vector mu, Bob's going to permute it and send to Alice. Alice can decrypt. And the secrets that Bob will have, they're going to contain some redundancy. For example, they're going to end with 20 zeros, so Alice will be able to distinguish a secret from randomness. So she'll be able to look at the vector and with high probability determine this is the secret that I should receive and output that secret. Okay, so this is the protocol that allows to compute the 2 millimeters problem. Okay, so this is sort of the first part of the talk, and if you have any questions, I can answer them now, and then I can move on to some extensions of this. Okay, so that was understandable. It should be easy. So I want, I said that I'm going to talk about privacy in auctions. So what is the setting there? There's an auctioneer that's sending, auctioning something, then the parties come, the bidders come, they make their bids, they send their bids to the auctioneer. The auctioneer determines who sent the largest bid by comparing the bids. And the parties, well, the winner gets to make a deal and the loser doesn't. So what is the security issue here is that there is no need for the auctioneer to know the non-winning bids, right? And this information is actually sort of important and useful. For example, if the auctioneer knows that Alice wants to buy a computer for $1,000, then she can misuse this information. So instead of sending plain text, and this is where comparing encrypted numbers comes in, instead of sending plain text to the auctioneer, it would be nice if you could send encryptions of your bids to the auctioneer, right? And now everything else is going to be the same. The auctioneer is going to send you back encryptions of whether you won or lost, and look, he doesn't know what the bids were because he only seen encryptions, right? And of course, just like before, maybe we don't want to send just a single bit back. We want to send back some kind of signed or something that is not easy to forge. So instead of sending back the value of the comparison, you might want to send back a contract for the winner and some kind of loser notification for the loser, perhaps. And the winner will get the output the contract, and the loser will not. Okay, so this this is what we call conditional encrypted mapping. I'm not going to get into the exact definitional notions, just a few things. So I guess we'll look at it as more of, not as a protocol, but as an algorithm. It seems to be more general. Because when you talk about the protocol, you have to immediately talk about some parties and who sends what to somewhere, right? But when you talk about algorithms, you don't care where the inputs come from. You, everything is going to work no matter what. And then it will be easier to just design one algorithm, and then you immediately can translate that algorithm into protocols in many settings. So talking about things as algorithms is more natural. Is more general and more natural. So these are inputs. I don't care where the encryptions of the X and Y come from. The encryptions with the same key. The secrets also are inputs. The predicate Q is public and is known. So the QSEM, the Q conditional encrypted mapping, will be two algorithms. One of the algorithms is called RMAP, which is randomized mapping. It's going to take all these inputs and it's going to produce a message M, or the output, right? And of course, there should be a corresponding recovery algorithm, which is called REC, and that algorithm should be able to take the message M that RMAP produced and a secret key and output the secret that corresponds to the value of the predicate on the plain text of the encryptions. Okay? So you see how if I give you this pair of algorithms, then it will help you run the auction somehow, right? Yes. S0 and S1, these are the secrets that auctioneer will send. I mean, these are inputs to the RMAP algorithms, right? But if you look at it from the application point of view, the auctioneer might set S0. Right, so this is where they come out, right? They come in there, they come out here. Okay, so the construction, and it, okay, so it's pretty similar to what, to the previous construction that I was giving, so it's sort of, we can start and see if it works, and where it doesn't work, maybe what we can fix. Alright, so now we start with X and Y, but we don't have X and Y, right? We have encrypted bits of X and Y somehow, right? So here I'm giving the algorithm for the auctioneer, or the RMAP algorithm, okay? So this algorithm will not have plain text of inputs, just encrypted bits, and the plain and the secrets. Okay, so we got those. Okay, like before, we can still compute vector D, right, because we can add or subtract encrypted numbers. So the difference vector, the differences we can compute, no problem. And the difference vector will look like this. It's going to be some zeros, and then in a position where X and Y are different, it's going to be either a 1 or minus 1, right, and some zeros, and et cetera. Okay, so it would be nice to compute, to be able to compute the vector F, but I don't know how, because now all of a sudden we cannot compute this value, right? Because, yes? Yeah, okay, so in the application, you would run to, you would, if you have two players, then when you submit your bid, you will need to submit your bid encrypted with both your key and the key of the other guy. This is sort of the uncomfortable question, but it's okay. Okay, does this answer your question? Okay. So these keys may be So for example, when you set up your crypto system, when you set up your auction system, you may register your public key with the auctioneer, and then these keys are become available for everybody, right? Okay, so we cannot compute the vector F. That's a little bit more difficult. But I still want to randomize everything except for this position, right? So the previous thing of this computing gamma can help me randomize whatever is to the right of the first position, right? If I compute this vector gamma like this, I'm going to set gamma 0 to be 0, and gamma I equals ri times previous gamma plus di, right? What this will give me is the vector of, so there's going to be a couple of zeros, the zeros, as long as d is going to be equal to 0, then gamma is going to be equal to 0, right? In the first position, where in the first position from the left, where d is not equal to 0, it's going to be the same value, right? And then it's going to be some randomness, random numbers on the plain text domain. Okay, so I sort of did half, but now there's two zeros, and I don't know how many of them, and I don't know how to get rid of them, right? I mean, if I just permute this vector and send back to Alice, it's not going to help me, right? Because there is this number of zeros, which, you know, then Bob will look at them and will say, ah, well, you know, it's only two zeros, so we differ in the third bit, right? And it somehow is not, you know, how to get rid of them. So what I want is a linear map. And I'm gonna run whatever a number of linear maps, a separate linear map for each of the coordinates. I want the linear map to map 0 to a random number. So I want whatever I obtain after applying this linear map, I want this being distinguishable from this, right? So it has to be random because these guys are random. So I want this linear map to map 0 to R, some randomness. And at the same time, I want it to do the right thing on the 1 or minus 1. So I want it to map minus 1 to S0 and 1 to S1. Okay, I'm going to show you how to get this linear map. Well, actually, so I cannot give you this linear map because there's three restriction points and it's only straight line. So such linear map does not exist. Right? Oh, yeah, and linear things are the only things you can do under encryption. You cannot do quadratic, so you cannot satisfy these things. I mean, you can satisfy with quadratic function, but you cannot apply this function under encryption. But notice that I don't really have to give you exactly the secret. It is sufficient for me to give you a randomized encoding of a secret from which you will be able to obtain a secret later. Okay, and this actually turns out to be sufficient to help me. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to give a linear map that maps still maps 0 to a random value, but it's going to map a minus 1 to encoding of a secret 0 and a 1 to encoding of a secret 1. And the property of encoding is that ESI, from looking at ESI, you're going to be able to obtain SI, the secret, and no other information theoretical. Okay? So if I give you this linear map, now you believe me that everything will work out, right? Because what I'm going to do, I'm going to create a number of linear maps, one for each of the coordinates. I'm going to apply linear map to each of them. And what this will do for me is going to map 0 to a random value, 0 to a random value. This thing, the 1 is going to be mapped to the right thing, which contains a secret. And then the linear map is not going to destroy randomness that is already exists in the in the other elements of the vector. Okay, so this slide shows you how to construct that. So I'm given two secrets, S0 and S1, and I want to construct this F of X and to show how to construct and describe what are these ES0 and ES1 are. And these are the properties that I want to satisfy. F of minus 1 is equal to ES0, etc. Right? So basically, I'm repeating the setup of the problem from the previous slide. Okay, assume that the secrets contain redundancy. That's not a problem. So I'm going to choose a random element of the plain text domain. So the Pallier scheme has plain text domain Zn, where n is the RSA number. So I'm going to choose a random element of that domain. And if you write that down as bits, I'm going to split it in half. I'm going to look at the left half and the right half. Okay, left half I'm going to call R0. The right half I'm going to call R1. Okay, and if you want to write it out mathematically, what will happen is that R is equal R0 times 2 to the power k plus R1. So there's no wraparound there at all, right? And I'm going to set both ES0 and ES1 to be equal to R. These are not final things. This is just sort of, you know, intermediate assignments. So you can look at these as empty containers, and I'm going to stick secrets in those empty containers somehow. And how I'm going to stick the secret, I'm going to throw in ES0, I'm going to throw out the top half. I'm going to throw out the R0 and then put S0 there instead. Okay, so not XORing. I'm just throwing out completely what was there and I'm putting new thing. Okay, so now ES0 it clearly contains a secret and pretty much no other information. And similarly, but on the right side, I'm going to throw out R1 and I'm going to stick S1. Okay, so this is pretty much what I want, almost what I want. Now I'm going to set the function f, and it's a linear function. I'm going to set it to satisfy the first two equations, 1 and 2. I'm going to solve for these equations. I'm going to obtain a and b, right? This will be my linear function. And it turns out that the third equation is satisfied for free for me. The third condition that I want is satisfied, right? So you can check, because f of 0 is what? F of 0 is b, you solve this for b, you get 1 half ES0 plus ES1, right? When you substitute your ES0 and ES1, these are the substituted, so this is ES0 and this is ES1, right? So one thing you can notice that if you look at them differently, this is R, right? R1 plus R0 times 2 to the power k is the R that I chose uniformly randomly from the plaintext domain. So what happens is f of 0 is equals to 1 half times r plus something, and that's something that does not depend on r. Okay, so it's r prime, it's a random number on the plain text domain. Okay, everybody convinced? Okay, so that was a sort of cute trick, I think, that because there's some difficulty of how do you actually get a uniformly random number on that. And I wanted to not be computational, but information theoretic randomness. So the only thing that is missing is that if you look, if I give you ES0, then you're going to, well, you don't know whether it's ES0 or ES1, right? You're going to look at it, you're going to look at the left, you're going to look at the right. One of these two is going to be a secret. If it happens that the secret is on the left, then you're going to know that it is ES0, and that's leaking some information. I don't want to leak that information. But this one is really easy to fix. I'm going to flip a bit, and then that bit will tell me whether I'm going to put it on the left or on the right. Okay, so that was the construction, the complete construction questions.
Just some differences on the previous the one that's computing this thing actually knows.
Why?
Knows one of the secrets.
Secrets? The secret, he knows y in plain text, right? And that allowed to compute the vector f, which is really helpful. He knows y in ciphertext, he cannot compute f.
How much less efficient is this than the original y in plain text?
No, it's not. It's pretty similar, yeah. I guess loss of efficiency, main loss of efficiency is that I can only transfer half of the bandwidth, right? Which is for Palier is 1024 bits. So it depends on your application. This may come for free. Maybe you don't want to transfer. If you're transferring a key, 128 bits, then that is no loss at all. The resource comparisons, there previous works of Fishman and DiCrescenzo, they did not use Palier, they used Goldwasser-Micali, and in those schemes, it seems to be difficult to get something as efficient, and I don't know, I don't know if it's possible at all. So Golgotha Mikali operates on single bits, and here we're using that. We have a large bandwidth under the encryption, and this helps us a lot. So this is the sort of complicated write-up, but the improvement is a factor of either NC or lambda C, depending on one of the previous works you're comparing with, where N here is the number of bits in the numbers you're comparing. C is the number of bits in the secret that you're sending. So here I'm sending secret, well, you know, C bit secret in one go, right? So that gives me immediately a factor of C improvement. And lambda is the correctness parameter, which, you know, reflects the probability of making an error. So if you have correctness lambda, then the probability of error is 2 to the power minus lambda. 1 over 2 to the power lambda. So I guess I should say that our model is that Alice and Bob, in our model, Alice is computationally unbounded. And this is important. This is significantly different from a model where Alice is computationally bounded and Bob might be computationally unbounded. In the other model, where Alice is computationally bounded, or so polynomially bounded, you can use Yao's garbled circuit approach, for example. And that one is the most efficient known protocol for the greater than. And the Yao's efficiency is approximately equal to what we have. But if but you cannot use Yao in when Alice is computation bound, because when you have Alice and Bob, in Yao, Bob sends encryptions of things to Alice. You cannot do that. If Alice, you cannot send encryptions to Alice. Right, because Alice is unbounded in our case. Okay, so that's the summary and the papers. The papers appeared in Asia Crypt 2004 and Financial Cryptography 2006. So this talk was based on these two papers.